Okay, so once again, for the sake of the people listening on the podcast and CDs or whatnot, if I sound a little blue today, it's because we've just lost a dear brother, Andy, who is one of our elders for many years and missionary to Russia. He just got back Tuesday. What was it, 63rd, 64th trip to Russia, something like that. And so anyways, it's we're all just still kind of recovering from that. I do want to share this on the recording, though. When I sat down with Hilda and Mikkel and some of the family members Thursday night, I just happened to remember what the Torah portion was about this week. And I talked to Hilda about that. She says, yeah, I've been reading it. And it's Abraham mourning for his bride because she's died. And then, at the end of the portion, Abraham dies and his sons come to mourn his death. But in between these two events, there's a wedding. I guess you could call this portion two funerals and a wedding. And but how appropriate that this week, you know, that when, as we read about Abraham mourning the death of his spouse, and then Ishmael and Isaac coming together again, reuniting to bury their father, Abraham. And then in the middle of that, Isaac calling a bride. You know, we live in a world of death. We live in a place where it's fatal. This is a fatal place. So we all were born here with an expiration date, you know. And but in the midst of the death, there's a bride being called. And in a nutshell, that's what this whole Torah portion, Chaya Sarah, is all about. And you know, it's thinking about Andy's life and so on. Andy wasn't perfect. He's a lot closer to it than I am. And he was a righteous man. And whenever someone close passes away, it makes me remember that my time here is short. And today I have one last day to spend here than I did yesterday. My each day just ticking off towards my funeral. And it makes me take inventory. Am I a righteous man? You know, I know that I have a Savior. And I know He's a forgiver of sins. He's paid the price of sin. But I do know that though my salvation is based entirely upon grace, I know that my reward is based entirely upon my works and how I live this life. And I guess the question is, how am I doing? How can I even tell how am I doing? Can I tell how I am doing? Which makes me think again of last week in our discussion about Lot, who seems to be just a miserable individual. And yet Peter, over in 2 Peter 2, 7 and 8, refers to Lot as a righteous man. I'll never forget last week going through the study and just kind of mapping out all of Lot's failures. And just going through all the references after with Lot, and then suddenly remembering at the end, coming to 2 Peter and thinking, he was a righteous man? I had to go back and rethink everything. But Peter says, and if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. That he's the one who chose to go live there. But he's called righteous three times in this passage. How can that be? So you go back, you look at his life, you have to really look closely to try to find anything he did right, because he did so much wrong. But there are two things I can find that he did right. When he saw the messengers, whether he knew they were angels or not, I kind of think he might have, but I don't know. He extended hospitality to them and brought them into his home. And then when the members of the city came to commit a violence against these messengers, Lot protected them. He stood in the gap. He told them, no, don't deal wickedly like this. Don't do this. And he put himself in a place of danger to protect these two. Those are the only two things I can find in the Word that Lot did right. He extended hospitality to God's representatives. And he stood there and protected them from harm. So what did God do? He he extended hospitality to Lot. You come be with me, and I'll protect you from the destruction coming to Lot, to Sodom. Right? Am I getting this wrong? But God did for Lot what Lot did for God's messengers. I think this might be why it says over in Hebrews 13:2, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. So you don't know the significance of even little actions that you do. But Lot, what a character he was. And so this week, you know, just kind of, you know, what I often, you have to understand how I work. I read the Torah portion of the week and I get these little gleamers of ideas. But usually about Thursday, then Friday is when I sit down and figure out what I'm actually going to do here. Sometimes it's not till Shabbat morning that it actually starts to come together. But with Andy's death, everything kind of got sidetracked. So I'm just going to share thoughts and some stories and things have been going around in my mind. So this is not a very highly structured teaching. Of course, most of my teachings probably don't seem that highly structured anyway. I want to share with you what I call the faith of four kings. Let me just share the passages, then I'll give you the story that ties these together. First king is David. And in Psalm 18:37, it says, I pursued my enemies and overtook them, and did not turn back till they were consumed. And then First Samuel 30:17 comments upon this event and says, and David struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day. The second king is the king Asa. And 2 Chronicles 14:13 says, Asa and the people who were with him pursued them as far as Gerar, and the Ethiopians fell until none remained alive, for they were broken before the Lord and his army. The third king is Jehoshaphat, or Jehoshaphat, as you may commonly hear it pronounced. 2 Chronicles 20:22 says of him, and when they began to sing and praise the Lord set an ambush against the men of Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, who had come against Judah, so that they were routed. And then the fourth king is Hezekiah. 2 Kings 19:35 says, and that night the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. Now what ties these four kings together? Well, there's a story in the Midrash Rabbah, which contains stories that were well known in the first century. Yeshua knew these stories, and his apostles knew these stories. Paul knew these stories, and these stories are often cited in the New Testament scriptures. Many times you think, how did Paul know that? How did John know that? It's not in the Bible. It's because they knew it because it was written in their stories. The Midrash Rabbah, the great commentary, you could call it, the great Bible study. This is what it says, and it refers to these four kings. There were four kings. That which one asked for, the other did not ask for. They are David, Asa, Jehoshaphat, and Hezekiah. David said, I will pursue my enemies and I will overtake them. The Holy One, blessed he, said to him, I will fulfill it. And then it says, David smote them from evening until the next evening. Asa stood up and said, I don't have the strength to kill them. Rather, I will pursue them and you do it, God. So the Holy One, blessed is he, said to him, I will fulfill it. As it says, Asa pursued them. But notice it doesn't say he struck them down. Jehoshaphat stood up and said, I don't have the strength either to kill or to pursue. Rather, I will sing in praise and you do it. So the Holy One, blessed is he, said to him, I will fulfill it. As it says, as soon as they began their singing and praising. Hezekiah stood up and said, I don't have the strength either to kill or to pursue or to sing in praise. Rather, I will sleep on my bed and you do it. So the Holy One blesses as he said to him, I will fulfill it. As it says, and that night the angel of the Lord went out and smote the Assyrian camp. You see why they're tied together? So which one was the more righteous? Which one was the more holy? Which one had the greatest faith? You'd think that the one who did the least had the greatest faith. He had so much faith in God that, God, I have so much faith in you, I'm going to trust you to do it, I don't have to do a thing. Which would be Hezekiah. But our Messiah is called the son of David. David is considered to be the greatest of the kings. And yet he did the most here. Does that mean his faith was the least? Does this mean he did not depend upon God as much as he should have, and so he took more upon himself? He pursued them, he struck them down, he did it all? What's the story? This is the story. One of the great rabbis comments on this midrash, and he says, if the Lord was willing to help Hezekiah to the point that he did not need to do anything at all, why didn't the other kings who preceded him ask for this? Why did David have to fight, Asa to pursue, and Jehoshaphat to sing praise? Clearly, Hezekiah was not the greater than those who preceded him. He was not greater than David the king. But each person is obligated to do all that he has the strength to do and no more. David the king, since he had the strength to fight, was obligated to do so. That's an important lesson. And then when we think about Lot, what did he have the strength to do? Not much. Not much. He didn't have the strength to resist Sodom. Didn't have the strength to leave it after he saw how wicked it was. He just lived there and was miserable because of the wickedness around him. But he had the strength to invite some messengers into his home. He had the strength to go outside and try to talk the town out of molesting them. And what did God do? God calls him righteous man. But Abraham had much more strength. Much more is required of him. And he fulfilled it. But neither men were perfect. Neither of these men were perfect. We see not only a lot of flaws in Lot. Maybe that's why I call him Lot. He had a lot of flaws. But in Abraham, we also see some flaws, but he kept growing and growing. So what's the difference? And I think it's because Abraham had a stronger heart. You know, last week we were quoting some passages, and Sharon mentioned Jeremiah 17:9. The King James reads this way, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, who can know it? Which is probably one of the worst translations in the entire King James Bible, and there are many terrible translations in the King James Bible. Might I just encourage you right now, if you have a King James, keep it on the shelf. Keep as a keepsake. Do not use it for study because it's damaging. Because it's so riddled with terrible translations that have affected and damaged believers since 1611 when it came out. Now, if it was the only translation in English, okay, we work with it. But it's not the only translation, and it's by far the best. So you have a King James, put on a shelf. It may be worth something someday. But there are better translations. And NIV you can put up on the shelf next to the King James. It's not a good translation either. In fact, it doesn't even claim to be a translation. It's a paraphrase, not a translation. All right? There are many good translations out there. But no translation can truly communicate the purity of the original Hebrew. And it's like Boaz Michael writes in the foreword to the Delitzsch Gospels that every translation is a commentary. It can't be avoided. It simply cannot be avoided. So find the best translation you can. That word that the King James translated desperately wicked, it's one word in Hebrew. It's the word anush. Anush. In fact, further down in Jeremiah 17, verse 16, that word is used again. I have not run away from being your shepherd, nor have I desired the day of woe, or the woeful day. That's also the word anush. This is called the desperately wicked day. In fact, there's no other translation I found that translates this word ever as wicked. It means weak or sick. It's the weakness that comes from illness. And that's what it says about our hearts. Let's read it again. This is the way it should be translated. The heart is a Jacob. Akov halev mikol. The heart is a Jacob above everything. It's a Jacob. Was Jacob a wicked man? No, he was a weak man. He was a clever man. He's a deceptive man. But he's considered to be a righteous man. After all, God calls himself the God of Abraham and Isaac. And I think I would have left Jacob off, maybe. But he says, no, I'm the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. So the heart is a Jacob. And it's so weak. Who can know it? That's our problem. Not wicked hearts, weak hearts. Weak hearts. Yes, Valerie. I don't know. Are they weak? Are they sick? Are they just plain lazy? I don't think God's going to bless laziness. I think what God requires is what we can do. To whom much is given, much is expected. To whom a little is given, not so much is expected. For example, I mean, that's a great question. I don't have a great answer for it. But here's an example. Genesis 6:9. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, and it says he was blameless, I think the word is tameh, in his generation. So the question the rabbis asked, how righteous was he? His whole generation got destroyed, so he didn't have much competition. But was he a truly righteous man? He was righteous enough to walk with God. And again, over in Genesis 7, verse 1, then the Lord said to Noah, go into the ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. In other words, of all the people on the earth, you're the one who's the most righteous. And yet, how did Noah end his life? The last time we see him, where is he? What's he doing? He's just survived a terrible destruction, and he's in his tent, drunk, having some kind of a strange encounter inflicted upon him by his son, Ham. And how does Lot end his life, righteous Lot? The last time we see him, he's in a cave, having survived a terrible disaster, drunk, having something inflicted upon him by his two daughters. God calls them both righteous, but their endings aren't very happy. It's a fascinating thing to think about. Yes, Deborah. Pardon me? Are you talking about Noah? Jacob? Yeah, no, Joseph was absolutely a righteous man, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, Noah's great-great-great-great-granddaughter is Ruth. I guess the point I'm trying to make this week is that probably none of us here are utterly wicked, and none of us here are utterly righteous. We're the in-between people. I think Benoni is the term that the Hebrew uses for this. The in-between ones. We're the in-between ones. And one of the things I notice about me is I can make progress one day towards God and I can go in reverse the next day. We are so fickle. What we must do as human beings is we must continue to pick ourselves up and make progress towards Him. We'll fall down, but we get back up and we keep going forward. we'll get distracted, just like our little dog Oscar, turn around and run the wrong way. But eventually he comes to his senses, and then he has to make up for what he lost and get back on the right way. That's how we are. We're so easily distracted. We so easily get off course. Yes, Fred. Yeah, the disciples. Yes, even though he was called Satan, even Peter was called Satan by the master, and yet he becomes the head of the congregation there in Jerusalem. Here's another passage that comes to mind, Revelation 2:24. This is Messiah's letter to Thyatira. He's writing to believers who live much like Noah lived in his wicked generation, and much as Lot lived among the wicked people of Sodom. And here's what Messiah says to them: "But to the rest of you in Thyatira, who do not hold this teaching, who have not learned what some call the deep things of Satan, to you I say, I do not lay on you any other burden." In other words, I'm not expecting much from you. I'm just expecting this little bit. That's the only burden I'm giving you. I'm a small one because that's all you can handle. You understand? You know, I know when I would watch a movie with one of the kids when they were little. First thing you want to know when a character appears, is he a good guy or a bad guy? And you know we're all the same way today. And we tend to take the people we know, we categorize them as good or bad. And people do the same thing with us. Because we're very black and white people. We like to put people in the category of good or bad. And then just kind of leave them there. But God doesn't do that with us. So here we can have a person like Lot being called righteous. And then Abraham, also righteous. But what a vast difference there is between the two. An incredible difference between the two. Yes, Jim. Yeah, since righteousness and faith are very much connected, very closely connected, aren't they just a gift from God? Yeah, they are. But the question is, what are you doing with that gift? Are you growing it or burying it? Messiah says if you just have faith to the degree of a mustard seed, that's all it takes. But you better plant that mustard seed and make it grow, right? And when he gives the talents to the servants, even these talents, he wants them to grow them, to invest them. What did the one do who thought he was doing good? He just buried it and he returned every bit of it back to the master when he came. He was called wicked because he didn't invest it and make it grow. So yeah, we all have different starting points, I guess. We have different levels of faith that God has given us as a gift. But which direction are you moving? It's not a static thing. I'm going to share another story with you. And this one's a little longer. This is from the Talmud. And I've pondered this story ever since I first came across it here a few years ago. And it's a very odd story, but I want you to pay attention to it because the Talmud's a very odd book. And the parables that are found throughout Judaism can be very odd at first. But stick with it and you'll find this to be, I think, very profound. This is a story about a rabbi whose name was Eleazar ben Pedas. Okay, we'll just call him Rabbi Eleazar. And Eleazar was a very, very, very poor man. He was in poverty his whole life, but he was a brilliant man, a great teacher of the Torah, and a very godly man. And he grew very sick. He was very sick and weak, and he fell into a deep sleep. And his disciples noticed that while he was sleeping, he cried. And then later, he laughed. And then later, they saw a flame coming out of his forehead. I told you this is a bizarre story, okay? So I warned you. And it says, when he awoke, they asked him why he cried and laughed in his sleep. He told them, "The Holy One, blessed is He, was sitting with me." The Holy One, of course, referring to God. "And I asked Him, 'How long shall I suffer poverty in this world?' And God answered me, 'Eleazar, my son, would you like me to change the whole world around from its very beginning? Perhaps you will be born at a time that your destiny will be one of prosperity.' And I said back to him, 'After all that, is it still just a matter of perhaps?'" Because God said, "Perhaps you'll have a destiny of wealth." He says, "Then I asked him, 'Well, is most of my life in front of me, or have I already lived out most of it?' And the Lord answered me, 'You have already lived out most of it. This is why Rabbi Eleazar cried in his sleep.' Then I said to him, 'If that is so, I don't want you to change around the whole world for my sake.' 'As a reward for saying this,' God replied, 'for saying, I don't want you to change the world around for my sake, I will give you 13 rivers full of fine balsam oil in the world to come. Rivers as big as the Euphrates and the Tigris for your pleasure.'" Now, rivers of balsam oil are like an idiom in the Talmud and in Jewish thought for spiritual pleasure, spiritual joy. So God says, "Because you said, 'Don't change the world around for me,' in the world to come, I'll give you 13 rivers, the size of the Euphrates and Tigris, filled with balsam oil for your pleasure. This is why Rabbi Eleazar laughed in his sleep." So I said back to God, "Is that all I will receive?" And God said, "But then what will be left for me to give to your colleagues?" And I said to him, "Am I asking from a man who doesn't have more to give?" In other words, he's saying, "Lord, 13 rivers of balsam oil, that's wonderful. But can't you give more? I mean, aren't you limitless?" And God says back, "But if I give you more, what will be left to give to your colleagues?" You follow? And I said to God, "Am I asking from a man who doesn't have more to give?" Then the Holy One, blessed is He, gleefully tapped me on the forehead with a finger and said, "Eleazar, my son, I have struck you with my arrow. This is why a spark of fire emanated from Rabbi Eleazar's forehead." Odd story, isn't it? But filled with meaning. So let's go through and dissect this. Rabbi Shimon Pinkus, who's a great living rabbi today, he says, "Let's focus on the latter half of the conversation between Rabbi Eleazar and the Holy One. As reward for accepting his lot, Rabbi Eleazar was promised 13 great rivers flowing with precious balsam oil. This represents spiritual pleasures in the world to come. But this was not enough for Rabbi Eleazar. He wanted more. Why? Rabbi Eleazar's argument to the Holy One, blessed is He, was as follows. If we are speaking of reward in the world to come, which is a world of eternity and infinity, why should my reward be limited to only 13? Give me a boundless reward as befits the world to come. And God answered and said, if I give everything to you, what will be left for the others? And Rabbi Eleazar responded, I'm not asking this from a human being. I know that people are limited to what they have to give. I'm asking it from you, the master of the universe. And your capabilities are absolutely limitless. The Lord's reaction to this was anything but calm. He gleefully gave Rabbi Eleazar a tap with a finger and excitedly exclaimed, I have struck you with my arrow. The Lord was saying, so to speak, great answer, but you deserve a slap. You know, when I got to this part, I was riveted because I have felt that way so many times. I felt in my heart God saying, great, you did a good job there, but you still deserve a slap. I feel that pride just about every Saturday afternoon after I leave here after teaching. I say, Grant, good job. You did good. We still need a good smack. Now why? Why did Rabbi Elazar get this response from God? Why did Rabbi Elazar deserve a slap? Wasn't his argument compelling and correct? Didn't he rather deserve a kiss? It seems that the Lord was hinting to Rabbi Elazar, I'm absolutely delighted by the wonderful things you say, but I still find fault with you. What was the fault, do you think? Before I go on, what was the fault that you think God found with Rabbi Elazar?
Greed.
Greed? No, that wasn't it at all. You know, that's the first thing I would have thought. Greed. He's greedy, but that was not it. God was delighted that he realized that God was limitless. Limitless. And when God said, well, if I give more to you, what will I have to give to others? And Elazar says, come on, you can't fool me. You have an eternal supply. Giving more to me does not in any way diminish someone else's supply. And God was delighted with that. But what fault did God find with him? Wasn't greed. Not greed. What's that? Nope, that's not it either. Jim. Nope, wasn't that either. Yes. Nope, wasn't that either. Rosemary. For not being faithful, you're getting close. That Lazar was faithful, but it was a question of faith. His faith wasn't strong enough. That's what it comes down to. You're saying, how can that be? That's, you know the reason you can't see why his faith wasn't strong is because we are all just like Rabbi Elazar. That's why you can't see it.
Thankful.
I thought you said faithful. Now she's covering herself. She's saying both, yeah. Robin. Yes. That's exactly it. If you didn't hear Robin's answer, then we'll just read a little bit further. First of all, Rabbi Pinkus, he comments, he says, first of all, let's take a look at how the Lord runs the world. We'll notice an interesting thing. The Lord does not have a basket of goodies that he distributes equally to all. For instance, I know a certain couple that has 17 children, another couple that has 20 children. On the other hand, I know a couple that has been married for 16 years, they don't have a single child. Why divide it up like that? Why does he give 20 to one couple, none to another? Why not give 10 to each? Then everybody's happy. You see, that's not how God runs things. He says, God does not give out goodies from some kind of a little basket. On the contrary, each person receives straight from the infinite source for all blessing. What I receive has absolutely nothing to do with what the next person gets. So the Lord got excited, so to speak, over Rabbi Elazar's wonderful answer, but he also gave him a tap and a rebuke. The Lord told him, so to speak, my dear child, you just said such a wonderful thing. I am absolutely delighted. But where were you before? What were you thinking when you asked me for wealth and I answered you that this is impossible because you were born under a fortune of poverty, a destiny of poverty? I explained to you that in order to try to fulfill your request, I would have to change around the entire world and start everything again from scratch. And you accepted this as an answer? Why didn't you say then what you say now? You should have said, Master of the universe, since when are your capabilities limited? Surely you can arrange a decent destiny for me. Here's Elazar's problem. He had all kinds of faith in what God could do in the world to come. But his faith about what God could do here and now was very limited. You see the discrepancy? And then the rabbi comments something that's absolutely brilliant. Why did God tap him on the forehead with his finger and say, I've sent my arrow against you? These are incongruous. An arrow is something you send towards an enemy who's at a distance, right? And so to speak, God saying, your faith has a long ways to come, to come up to the level I want you to be. But he tapped him on the forehead to say, but I'm right here. I'm this close to you. I'm right here. Why can't you have faith in me for now? And why do you necessarily want to change your destiny here? I'm right here with you, and I destined poverty you because it's good for you. In fact, if I didn't, we wouldn't have this story we're reading here 2,000 years later. Do you understand the picture? We tend to be very lopsided in our faith. Like G.K. Chesterton said, we have faith in God to give us life eternal and the world to come, and yet we don't know what to do with ourselves on a rainy Sunday afternoon. We have all the time of eternity, but we don't know what to do for the next 5 minutes. We have faith in God to reward us, to resurrect us, to have a wonderful eternity with Him. But right now we just wait to die. You understand? He's saying that God is just as close to us right now as He will be then. Which brings me to another story. Some years back, I came across a comment by Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, who lived in the first half of the 20th century. Very godly man, extremely godly man. And he says there are five basic levels of faith. And he gives them from the lowest to the highest. Now here, again, we're all these in-between people, right? We all have faith, but none of us have as much as we should. All of us have a righteous walk with God to some degree or other, but none of us are where we should be. And so maybe this will help you to figure out where are you on the scale. And Rabbi Dessler says there are five levels of faith. Lowest level, number one. This is the person who believes that the creation is a pure accident. In other words, there's no faith at all. It just happened, and there's no God. Okay? So that's no faith at all. I don't think any of us are there. Second level, you take the first step up. This is the person who believes God created the world, but has no further involvement with it. I believe in a creator. I believe He designed and brought this world into existence, but He's not really involved. So there's a little bit of faith. The next person, the next step up, is the person who believes that God created the world and continues to maintain it by His power. And He's personally involved every moment of every day of running the world and maintaining it and making it survive and directing its history. Now that's where probably the bulk of believers are. Which means you're halfway up the ladder. Which means you get a 50% grade on your faith, which is failing. The next step is the person who believes that God created and maintains the world, and every minute detail proclaims His presence, His love, His truth, and He sees God in every single bit of creation. He sees Him everywhere. And remember our definition of spirituality is a person who sees God everywhere and in everything but remains quiet about it. And then the fifth level is the person who's so aware of God's presence in everything, in every heartbeat, in every breath, and every encounter with every human, with everything in the creation. He's so aware of God's presence, he's kind of surprised that there is a physical creation at all. It seems so unnecessary to even have a physical creation. Look at the ends of the spectrum. Here's the one person who's so aware of the physical creation, he sees no need for God. And here's a person who is so aware of God, he doesn't see a need for a physical creation. Where are you at in this progression? And you know, in some things in your life, you may be at one level, but in other areas of your life, you may be at another one. We're complex people, aren't we? Complicated people. You know, we probably should look at the Torah portion for a moment. I want to apply this principle to a detail in the portion, since we have some time. You know, in this Torah portion, I love this story. Between the death of Sarah, between the death of Abraham, you have this wonderful story where the father sends his servant into the far country to call a bride for his only begotten son. Sound like a familiar theme? And so Eliezer, which means my God is help, or my God is strong, Eliezer, he goes as he's commanded. What a picture of the Holy Spirit he is. He goes as he is commanded. He arrives at a well, and he decides that he'll recognize the maiden, he'll recognize the bride, because she'll do two things. It's in chapter 24, verse 14. This is what he says. Let it be that the maiden to whom I shall say, please tip over your pitcher so I may drink, and who replies, drink, gives him water, does what he asks. But then a second thing. And says, I will even water your camels. Her will you have found correct or appropriate for your servant, for Isaac. This is a powerful insight. You know, in so much of evangelicalism today, we think the gospel is taking a message, present it to an individual, and having them say yes to the message, and then telling them, okay, now they're saved. This would be like Eliezer going, saying, the maid who I encounter and say, give me to drink, and she gives me to drink, that's her. That's it. She's in. But who wouldn't say that? I mean, just probably every single girl he could have met there at the well, he could have said, I'm thirsty. May I have a drink? Probably every single one of them would say, sure, of course you can. Only a very wicked person would say, no, you can have it. Get your own pitcher. Get your own water. Nobody would do that. See, there's a second requirement. First of all, there was a verbal request and a verbal response. But there was an unspoken request that required a response as well. Put yourself in Rebecca's place. You're coming down, it's a normal day, you're coming down to the spring to get some water. And here's a man, and you see the camels and the servants, and obviously they've been on a very long journey, and they've arrived here. And none of them has a pitcher. And so the man says, may I have something to drink, some water to drink? And you give it to him. But in your heart, you see a need greater than what was requested. You see a greater need than what was stated. And in your heart, you know you're in a position to meet that unspoken need. And that's the kind of woman that the servant is calling to be a bride for the only begotten son of the Father. There's a spoken request and there's a physical response. But there's also this spiritual thing, this unspoken thing that the heart responds to as well. I guarantee you, I can get anyone to pray any prayer at all. I guarantee you, if I can't do it by convincing them with logic to say the words to ask Jesus into their heart, I can hold a gun to their head and they will. I can get them to say the words. That's not a problem. But there's no way in this world I can make their heart one that aligns itself with Abraham's, with God's, with Messiah's, with the Spirit. You see, Eliezer, he was looking for a woman who had a heart like Abraham's. Because how did Abraham respond? When he was sitting at the flap of his tent and he saw some strangers in the distance, he got up and he ran to them. Please come to my tent and you can eat, you can wash your feet, you can rest under the shade of the tree, and I'll prepare he made a feast for them. So Eliezer's looking for a woman that has that kind of a heart. You see? Because he knew the father's heart. He knew Isaac's heart. And Eliezer had that kind of a heart. And so he's looking for a girl that has that kind of a heart. Before he even knew her name, her family, anything about her, the heart told him everything he needed to know about her qualifications to be the bride. The question is, what kind of heart do you have? You know, for me, I might have said, I see your camels all thirsty, I'll loan you my pitcher. Or I might have said, you know what, let me get the other gals over here. We'll all get together and water your camels. Or I'd pour some water in the trough and say, listen, that's as much as I have time for today. I have to get home. But certainly one of the other girls will get down here and she'll finish the job for you if you ask nice. See, I'm somewhere in between. That's what I would be. Is that righteousness? Is that faith? I don't know. But I'm going to close with a few more stories. These are by a man named Mike Iaconelli. I think he's passed away. I came across his book years ago, and I copied these out, and they've been riding around with me in my notebook for a long time. What he describes in these two different encounters, two different women. So I'll just read it. He says, I was speaking at a conference recently and mentioned that a woman in my church, whom I deeply respect and who is one of the most godly women I know, smokes and sometimes uses colorful language. After the talk, I was made aware of a pastor in the audience who was outraged by my message. He was so angry that he demanded everyone from his church no longer listen to my talks. After the conference, trying to understand what he was so upset about, I contacted him. How dare you tell the audience that one of the most godly women you know smokes and uses the language of the world? He said quite heatedly. I answered, because she is one of the most godly women I know, and she does happen to smoke and use colorful language. The conversation went on for a long time, and he was not impressed with my defense. Although he didn't put it this way, what he was saying was clear. Godly women do not smoke, nor do they use colorful language, period. In his spiritual world, there is no place for smoking, swearing godly women. He didn't want to hear otherwise, no exceptions. In the real world, where I live, this woman is not an exception and remains one of the most godly women I know. Now let me read an account in the same book about a different woman. A couple of years ago, my wife and I sat across the table from a woman we highly respect, a deeply spiritual lady who had profoundly impacted our lives. This woman spent most of her life resisting the noise and activity of the world to seek God in silence and solitude. She had spent hundreds of weeks in silent retreat. This was a woman so saturated with her faith, you could almost smell God's fragrance when she came into the room. We were talking about prayer. It's embarrassing to be sitting with you, I blurted out. You spend days, weeks, even months in prayer. I'm lucky if I spend 10 minutes. Compared to you, I'm not very spiritual, I'm afraid. Her eyes flashing with anger caught mine and she fired back. Mike, knock it off. First of all, you don't spend every day with me. You don't know me at all. You are comparing what you know about yourself to what you don't know about me. Secondly, I battle depression daily. And it has won during several periods of my life. I never told you about it. I don't have a family. I like to be alone and silent. But trust me, I am just as unspiritual as you are. Then she said gently, you think about God all the time, don't you? Well, sort of, I said. And she said, thinking about God is being with God. Being with God is spirituality. Thinking about God is praying. So shut up with this guilt stuff. You have been praying most of your life. You are a spiritual person. Now, I don't want you leaving here thinking, oh, I can be spiritual and I can take up swearing and smoking. I don't want you to do that. That is not a license to go out and indulge the flesh or anything like it. What I'm saying is this. All of us somewhere are between Lot and Abraham in our walk of faith. And whatever you do, we need to keep growing. God, make me more like Abraham, who is the only person in the Bible who is called God's friend. God's friend. He's, of all the people in the Bible, except for Yeshua himself, Abraham is the most revered. He's the most praised in the Bible. He's the most elevated in all of the scriptures. Abraham. Because God initiated a blood covenant with Abraham, and you only make a blood covenant with a dear friend and an equal. And he's the only one who God calls his friend. So that's what we aspire for. God is the God of Abraham first, and Isaac, and Jacob. All three flawed men. But Abraham, you just don't get better than that unless you're Messiah himself. And then you got Abraham's nephew, Lot, who's also called a righteous man. But boy, he didn't do much. He didn't do much at all. Somewhere you're in there. So I guess what I'm asking you to do is encourage one another. Don't condemn each other when you see flaws. We already have one accuser of the brethren. And he doesn't need you to be Satan's little helper. He accuses the brethren enough to go around. He doesn't need your help. I tell you what the brethren do need. They need encouragement. They need you to catch them being good instead of being bad. They need you to pick them up, point them the right way, and walk with them a while. They need you to come along and spend time with them, listen to them, to talk with them. You know, when we were over at Hilda's house and just talking, something started stirring in me, and I started thinking what a bizarre thing conversation really is. And then last night we had some of the singles over, and we're sitting around talking and laughing and just fellowshipping and studying together, and people are sharing experiences, talking. I thought, what a weird thing conversation is. And why is it we as human beings say, let's get together and talk? Dogs don't say, let's get together and bark. What happens when you talk? What you're saying is, what you're really saying when you say, let's get together and talk, you're saying, I want your soul, your invisible, wonderful, holy soul, and my soul to intermingle. I want something to take place on a spiritual level where part of you becomes part of me and part of me becomes part of you. And my world gets bigger because now it takes on part of your world. That's what takes place in conversation. When you trade funny stories of things that happened to you, or sad stories, or experiences, or things you learned, or embarrassing moments, what you're doing, you're allowing your soul to absorb part of the others. You're becoming one. And it's the most human and the most spiritual thing in the world to do. It's an incredible thing. So let's use speech to build one another up, not to attack one another behind their backs. And I don't know that anybody is attacking anybody else. I guess since my dear friend Andy is gone from this world, and he was such an encourager and a man of peace, as Dan said earlier, and if you knew him, I know you don't have a single bad memory about him. And every memory you have of him is a good one. And in his absence, let's pick up his responsibilities. And we lost one Andy, so let's all each become an Andy. Let's let his absence multiply his presence here. And let's encourage one another the way he did. You know, I just don't remember him complaining much or anything else. He always was encouraging and and had a heart to serve. And when you were with him, you just felt built up and you felt loved. And we could use more of that. We really can. So let's do that. Let's quit trying to worry about how righteous this person is or that person over there or how faithful she is. Let's just be faithful. Let's be righteous. We have a long way to go, every one of us. Let's keep moving. The question is not where you're at, but which direction you're heading. And let's help one another, especially in these last days, to encourage one another to be obedient, be faithful, and encourage one another along. We could all use that. All right? So the person sitting next to you in the same room here with you never feels alone. All right? Makes sense? I guess it's a pretty basic lesson, but it's what you get this week. Hopefully next week will be better. But that's just what's been on my heart. So how about we close in prayer? Father, thank you so much for this time together. And I pray you'll take the halting words and thoughts and weave them together to something that's meaningful for your kingdom. But Lord, I know one thing I said today that is right and something you wish for us, and that is that we never be guilty of accusing one another and thus siding with our enemy. But Lord, let us side with Messiah, who encouraged, who built up, who loved, and helped his people, lifted them up, gave them his strength, and called them friends. So Lord, help us to be more like that. Make us the people you want us to be. And we have faith that you'll bring this to pass because we know it's your will for us. And we ask it in the precious name of Yeshua. Amen. Well, let's stand together as Ben comes to lead us in the blessing. And we're going to do something new starting this week. Those of you who have little ones you need to go and claim, we're going to let you leave now so you can beat the crowd because your little ones are anxiously waiting your arrival to rescue them from the mean teachers down there. So we're going to dismiss the parents at this time to get their kids. Please join.